Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, and I think a lot of you have listened to, over the last 2 years, a series called How Recruiting Works that I've conducted interviews with upward of 25 Division I head coaches, including today's guest, Harvard head coach Jerry Byrne. And today we're talking about how recruiting doesn't work. I think that a lot of folks have gleaned from that series some, I don't want to call it inside information, but some elements of recruiting that aren't that frequently discussed. And I think that the intention of this conversation is to be that and more. And while a huge part of this is reality, there's also a part of the reality that, you know, is less desirable to be discussed. And so some of the stuff that didn't come up on those prior conversations is exactly what Coach Byrne has in his crosshairs today. So GB, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
Terry, thanks. I feel like, you know, I'm the Paul Simon of the Terry Foy podcast. Every couple of months I come back on. So if you hate the sound of my Long Island accent, you can check off right now. But if it's endearing to you and I may curse a little bit and maybe have some opinions not everyone likes, then stick around.
Yeah, there you go. Well, so I want to start by, it's not a disclosure, but I do think that it's worth saying, you know, Inside Lacrosse sits at a very intersecting place within this space, right? We know that our content does a lot to influence the, I don't want to call it hysteria, because I do think that it is controlled, but, you know, this ever-increasing speed, velocity, momentum of the desire to be seen, evaluated, and create the opportunities and outcomes for yourself or more likely your child that has driven a lot of the other elements of the recruiting space, be it showcases, club team events, and the like. In addition to that, we also host tournaments. And, you know, one thing that when I have business development conversations, people are really surprised to learn about the percentage of Inside Lacrosse's revenue that comes from hosting these events. And it's upwards of 60%. So it's true to say, like, the 365-day coverage that we do likely would not be able to be done were it not for these events that we host. And that's just a reality. And so with that being said, I don't endorse everything that happens within the lacrosse recruiting ecosystem. But I also do understand that in many ways, this is a business. And I understand the judgment of, you know, when it comes to youth sports and the collision of business and youth sports, that's unpalatable for a lot of folks. But on the other hand, you know, you can shake your hand at clouds all you want, or shake your fist at clouds. It doesn't necessarily mean that things are going to change. So with all that being said, let's dive in. You've got a litany of topics that bump up against some of the things that I hear from the ecosystem that they want to see changed. But what gets under your skin the most? What was the thing that prompted you to want to have this conversation in the first place?
You know, I come at this thinking about, I think what's the most fundamental part of this is the potential relationship between the coach that you might play for and their parents and their son. And, you know, whether it was 30 or 40 years ago, there was no, you know, lacrosse industrial complex that surrounded the sport. And again, there was an imperfection around that. A lot of times you might call your friend who lived in a town or some quasi street agent that was blessing certain players off of another. That's how my older brother Steve got from Levittown Division High School to UVA, was because Tom Flatley had seen him play in a game at Garden City against his high school. So I'm not saying that was perfect, because plenty of other players maybe didn't get to their appropriate level because they didn't get kind of blessed by somebody else. But the setup of it now creates a lot of barriers between that potential relationship between a coach and a coaching staff and a son and his parents as they make this decision to do that. And it's not all bad, but the more convoluted, the more events, the more people, the more advice, the more opinion, the more media, the more noise, that creates, I think, as much anxiety amongst kids and parents, you know, on one side, and then on the coach's side, almost not, I wouldn't say a powerlessness, because that would be untrue, but, you know, us navigating the kind of internecine elements of how we find out more about a kid's ability or his drive or his, you know, the things that you can't see when they play 9 events every summer. Like, you're going to see ability and lack of ability and things that they can't do. You're not going to know some of these other things. And there's barriers and power going on behind that, that we're not interested in controlling that. We're just interested in making it more direct and simple. So that's kind of like my big picture of where I'm coming from.
One of the things that I think is, you know, kind of an important establishing point is for the, you know, last 15 years, you've been at institutions that were some of the most sought after opportunities that a young athlete could have. But it's not the only point of view that you have. I mean, you were a Division II coach prior to that as well. So you get it. I trust that you get both sides of it. But I also would imagine that, you know, maybe some of that element of recruiting at Notre Dame and Harvard is far different from recruiting at St. Mike's. But with that being said, so ultimately, like, your job is to effectively find the best 12 candidates every year from a pool of whatever number you want to set it at. I think it's in the neighborhood of like 2,500 to 5,000. And that is not a hard job. It is a hard job when you overlay it with the fact that you've got roughly a shade under 20 competitors who are striving for the same thing that you are striving for. And a lot of times that means that you're in the market for the same talent that you think can help your program. And that's the rub, right? If you were just independently trying to build the best team that you were able to build and your competition was kind of like faceless and benign, we wouldn't really be having this conversation, right?
Yeah, I don't think so, because I think there'd be a nearly perfect market for the assessment and communication, you know, with the assessment, you know, on my terms of what I think, how that assessment process should go on. And conversely, for a parent and a young man to, or how am I building my 365-day calendar around school, around my other sports, around my other obligations, and all of that. And, you know, that, and yeah, would be pretty easy in that way. If we had the technology we had today that they had 30 years ago and the system was the same, yeah, it would be really simple. You know, but where we are now, we're at the convergence of money and ego and anxiety and aspiration versus, you know, reality, you know, $1 million businesses, which again, I'm a capitalist right next to the next guy, and someone's desire to pursue and run a business is, you know, I don't want to get in the way of that. But, you know, I think, you know, true capitalism in its sense, part of it is taking advantage of a customer at times. And that, all of that kind of feeds into, like, when you hear people opining around parents or kids, is a lot of it is around the number of games that they're playing, the obligations to play, the how hard it is to do visits and assessment. And not just for a team at my level, I'm talking about for anybody who has these aspirations. So whether it's the messaging that they're receiving around, right, is there a pot of gold at the end of, pot of gold meaning either scholarship or admissions at a prestigious place, you know, what is the reality of that? Because we end up being the ones that have to deliver that reality. And that, you know, that makes it hard, and where there's a lot of blowback on schools around, well, they told me this and then it wasn't true and all these things. And so we end up being late to the process because of September 1st and all of that, and not controlling some of the narrative around how this goes, And then we have X number of months or X number of weeks to kind of play that out. And so, you know, I think that's one of the ways that it doesn't work.
That is the thing that is unique to 2024. The acceleration of volume of commitments. And I have been working on an article that analyzes the date of volume of commitments since July. And every time I get close to finishing it, it's like the end of the month. So I'm like, I might as well wait for another month's of data, month's worth of data to come in, and I can analyze the year-over-year change. But there is no question and no doubt that the speed in September and October of the best players committing accelerated by about double in both months. That is an extremely significant factor in this conversation, is it not?
Yeah, and again, the you have the situation where, and I say this to parents all the time, right? We control the staff at Harvard, we control our opinions, what we're able to, within the rules, glean from research and questionnaires, back when we could do questionnaires or send questionnaires, what we glean from watching guys play all summer. So that all that data gets you to a point. And then within the rules, the amount, the kind of information you can gain from the variety of influencers, well-intentioned club coaches, event operators, high school coaches, youth coaches, other sport coaches, you're creating this kind of palette of color, in the spring and in the summer that takes you to that point. We're not able to say what we really want to say, within the rules. And so we're more in the collection position. And then when you get to the first, you're kind of blind to what you think can happen. And some are more blind than others, and which is another thing. But so I control kind of what we feel about Terry Foy, who we saw play four different games over the summer. I might not necessarily know what Terry Foy is thinking specifically about Harvard. And then when the first happens, dominoes start to fall, and you can go from, oh, we were somebody's, we heard we were in their top four, and next thing you know, you're one. And it creates, whether it's musical chairs, whatever metaphor you want to use, and the music's starting to slow down, and there's only so many chairs left, and that which creates sometimes decisions that work out, but also sometimes decisions that don't. Meaning, I wanted a chair, so I'm choosing this place. It was my fourth or fifth choice, but I don't want to not have a place.
Totally. You've mentioned the word anxiety a few times, and I guess my question is, should the process be anxiety-free?
No, I don't think so. Listen, the part of it is whether you're looking at, or feeling like having hard club conversation with club coaches, that's one of the harder things. Like, I think, we see Terry Foy as the eighth best defenseman in our group. Whether you can do that or not, I don't know, but you're trying to find some mechanisms where you can kind of put people into groups, right? The club coach may think, we get conversation with club coach, this guy's the best defenseman in the class. You're like, okay, I know I'm not objective. I try to force myself to be, but I'm human like everybody else. But I know 100% I'm more objective than you. You'd love Johnny or Terry. You love Terry, you love his work ethic, and he's good. He's in our group. You see him as one more kind of like halo effect. You love everything about him and extrapolate that to some other character traits and things like that. So we get into tough conversations where guys are telling us, oh, he's the number one defenseman in the class. I'm like, all right, you may be right, but that's not what we think. So I think the anxiety is on both sides. We know we're imperfect. We're going to make imperfect assessments. If you have a recruiting class where 7 out of 10 become starters or major contributors at some point during their 4 years, that's a really good recruiting class. So means you're missing three or four guys that you're missing in their development or who they could be. So that's anxiety for us. But the anxiety for the kids, the unknown and somebody telling you information you might not like or someone you thought was going to offer you didn't. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's why, you know, I tell my team all the time, it's why athletes run stuff. It's because they fail every day and keep on showing up for practice. They walk across the bridge here at Harvard. They're getting kicked in the chops at practice. And then they go and get a paperback that has more red on it than a serial killer's basement. And so, they're used to dealing with anxiety. And so, I think there's a healthy amount of it. But where it gets, I think, amped up is in that gray area between something that might be true on September 10th that's not true on September 20th. And that's not the coach lying. It's I control us, you control you as the recruit. What you don't control is all the other mechanisms that are going on around you, at the other schools, at the other players who are in your peer group as from an ability standpoint. So that anxiety is probably hard to avoid. You know, unethical behavior or, you know, manipulating and lying and stuff like that, you know, I think that's part that goes with ruthless kind of capitalism. Part of this is 30 years ago, we were all complaining, we're not making any money and games aren't on TV. No one cares about the sport but us. But now you have most of those things. Guess what? There's going to be some prices, either personal prices or professional prices that will come with that.
You sent a list as we were preparing of topics that you wanted to discuss. And I think we're kind of butting up against one of them right now, which is what is really at the end of the rainbow for the kid and or for the parent. And that is so important. One of my biggest pet peeves when lacrosse is being promoted to populations that don't currently play is it is a great way to have an opportunity to play in college. And on the one hand, that is factually true. When you put it together alongside a bunch of peer sports, and I don't know, I haven't committed to memory the list of what's outside of this, but certainly basketball, hockey, soccer, football, track and field, baseball, wrestling, the list goes on. On a percentage basis, the number of high school players that end up playing in college is the highest in lacrosse. And it's certainly higher on the women's side than it is on the men's side even. But like 13% of high school players end up playing college lacrosse. And that's more than double in most of the other sports that I just named. But at the same time, when you create a transactional relationship to why you play, then what ends up happening is all the work that you put in becomes an investment that you expect a return on. And the returns are not... they're not equivalent, right? Like the opportunity to play at one institution versus another institution is not equally valued. And for those that do receive some sort of athletic aid, the amount that they receive is not always the same either. How do you assess that? Because it goes directly back to the point that we were just discussing with respect to free market capitalism, right? Like your athletic skill is a commodity that you are shopping in the market, and it is an imperfect market with some regulation, so you probably won't be properly compensated or the investment won't be properly returned on all of the time. But with that being said, what is your attitude towards a transactional relationship with lacrosse when, you know, I'm sure you've spent a decent amount of time, you know, teaching kids how to pick up a stick for the first time, pick up a ground ball, throw and catch, while also, you know, having coached some of the best players that have ever played the game.
Yeah, and I also had, you know, two children that went through this process and played in college. So, you know, I think it's really simple to, you know, be on some sort of horse. I'm not saying it's a high horse. Like, hey, you should be playing this because you love to play it and you're not thinking about, you know, well, can this skill get me something? You know, but that's, you know, I think, you know, closing that Pandora's box is probably long gone. It's just, this is a competitive world.
I actually disagree.
You know, okay, well.
I disagree. I think Pandora's box closes organically as the player base gets bigger and the percentage of conversion gets smaller. I actually think that is the most substantial thing that would change. Because when you look at it from the standpoint of soccer, obviously kids get involved in the soccer industrial complex at, you know, age 10 or whatever and get sucked up into it. And for those families, some have good outcomes and good experiences and others don't. But every kid plays soccer, and the vast majority of them start playing soccer not with the intention of getting anything back for it. So I think that is essentially the aspiration for the sport, is to get to the point where it is large enough, where it's something that you do for the sake of doing it as opposed to something that you do for the sake of what you get out of it.
And again, that bifurcation that can happen, I'm looking at the world through, trying to go from being a top 20 team to a top 10 team. And that, we're looking at very particular type students and players, just like all the other teams in Division I are trying to do. So, there's an element of realism that we have to have around what kids can we recruit, what kind of students do we need, what kind of, their aspiration for a place like this. That, we're constrained by that, by the rules about the kind of and the amount of information that we can collect. On the flip of that, what are the conversations from a reality standpoint, from a high school coach, from a club coach, from a recruit advisor, all that complex that's growing up now, is that what kind of information are they getting? If their aspiration is, I want to play in college, all right, you're going to be getting feedback at some point from somebody within that universe of influence, whether it's the college coach or the high school club advisor type thing. And the clarity of that reality, because college coaches in general are going to be very direct. And if they're not direct with you, they're probably direct with your influencer. Whether that information is getting to somebody who has this aspiration, that I think somewhere is where the anxiety piece really spikes. If there's a disconnection between where you think you are versus where you're told you are. Again, where you are doesn't mean where you're going to end up. There's plenty of guys who've been the last recruits in a bunch of classes I've recruited who've become our best players. So, but where are you now, trying to predict where you can be? And this is what, we've cobbled together Mr. Influencer, who has, messaging capability to a high school player. Like, this is where you are now. This is who's interested. And so if it's Hartford and not Harvard, that needs to be made clear. It doesn't mean the guy who's, Hartford is really interested as an example, shouldn't continue to aspire. But at some point, it should become clear, and those influences should help them. When that's not clear, and I'm not saying that it is or isn't, but I think there's times where it's not, that's where the anxiety goes up. And now I'm a parent or I'm a kid and I'm devoting, 60 days a year to tournaments and events and things like that. And at the end of the rainbow is if there's a huge disconnection between what I put in time and financially and where I get to, that's part of that is life, but also part of it can be kind of managed by both groups, but I think more importantly, all those people who influence those players.
Yeah, that's a perfect natural segue into the next topic that we wanted to address, which is the nature of kids playing too much. And you specifically pointed out the issue of arriving on campus as freshmen with pre-existing injuries that are a function of overuse. So I've got a lot to say about this. First and foremost, there are roughly 60 days of recruitable window. So not counting the spring season when college coaches do watch some high school lacrosse, but for the most part, they don't. It really does. The recruiting season really is a 61-day sprint from June 1st to July 31st. It really kind of effectively ends earlier than that in July, and it includes a 4-day break in the middle. And then it's 8 weekend days this month, at least, or this year rather, in November. So again, you're looking at it at about 60 days. Now,
developing around that is these tangential things that happen in October and December and January.
Correct. Yeah. So that is the emerging market of basically being able to pay coaches to be on site, not to recruit, but to coach, and then having the very obvious byproduct of the recruiting that would, or the player evaluation, if not the recruitment that would subsequently happen in conjunction with that. The nature of 2020, the way in which events were mostly allowed to start happening around July 1st. So everything that had been previously scheduled in June had an incentive to move into July. A lot of events that either didn't operate at all or were rescheduled created market opportunities for a new type of showcase to emerge. Inside Lacrosse participated in that with our ID experience, which falls outside of the recruitable window, or at least has in the fall. And then in 2021, all of the pre-existing events tried to come back, and it created a overloaded schedule on a, you know, 2019 and prior comparative basis. So effectively, the way that most of these things go is your club team probably plays three or four times over the course of the summer. And so that could be anywhere from 6 to, let's call it 10 days. A lot of national club teams that feature guests have emerged. And so if you so choose, you can participate in that and add, you know, let's call it 4-5 additional days of playing. Those individual showcases, be they the invitation ones or the tryout-based ones, I think a lot of high-level players participate in, let's call it 3 or 4 of those. Some of them are 1 day, some of them are 2. And so now you're looking at 20-ish days that you've played. And then there are college prospect days on top of that. So there are a reasonable number of players who probably play 25 to 30 days in that, you know, 55-day sprint in June and July. A lot of folks will argue that's too much because you're playing 6 to 8 hours each of the, well, maybe not 6 to 8, but, you know, if you're playing 3 games or maybe even 4, then you're looking at, you know, 4 to 5 hours. And when you compare it to what you've done for the 3 months leading up to that in your high school season, where, you know, you're probably practicing for 90 minutes to 2 hours, 4 days a week, and then, you know, playing 1 to 2 games that are 2 hours, it's a completely different volume. So FOMO is absolutely a factor in driving this. And I think a huge part of the FOMO comes from the myth of exposure, which is the thing that is separating me from the opportunity that I want is being seen by the coach who's going to make the decision to recruit me. I don't think that's really true. And I have said for 10 to 15 years that I think exposure is oftentimes the boogeyman that's used to explain the fact that your kid is just not quite as good as he or she needs to be in order to get the opportunity that either you want for him or her, or that she or he wants for her, him or herself. But I also think that it's hard to make that argument, absolutely, because there is a layer, and it depends on the program that we're talking about, right? But there is a marginal layer where oftentimes players are evaluated, and it depends on the coach, I know, but oftentimes players are evaluated on the basis of what they can do, not on the basis of what they can't do, or on the basis of what they do that is incorrect, right? So that is the argument for that one last opportunity for exposure being the difference, because if that one coach at that one institution that I badly want to go to sees me do that one thing that is the thing that he needs to see in order to recruit me, then all of the other work that got us to that point, all of the other overexertion, overextension that got us to this point is worthwhile. And it's about playing as many hands at the poker table or the blackjack table as possible. So it manifests in overuse, no question about it, and exhaustion and poorer performance, and really contributes to the anxiety that you're talking about, because it all costs money and it all increases the amount that you're investing in the hope of your hoped for return. How do you square it?
You know, I think the first thing you have to, you know, I'm a libertarian, meaning you want to start a club team, you want to start an event, you want to do private lessons, you want to hang your shingle out on the internet or whatever and claim your expertise, or I can help, you know, I can create an event that's going to help your kid, or I'm going to run a club team. I'm all for that, you know, because I think over the long term in most businesses, you know, cream rises, you know, your clarity and your honesty with your customer will carry a long way. If you don't do that, or if you promise things and don't deliver, or you don't do your operations really well, or, you know, the details that go into it to put a good team out at an event or execute a good event on your side. Like, I think in most businesses, that stuff shakes out pretty quickly. I don't think it shakes out as well in lacrosse. Not that I think there's an unrealistic level of expectation of how good my kid is or things like that, but I think the chase for scholarship or a school to really love them, that's in some level of, not legitimate, but, you know, prestigious, you know, is, you know, I think that just like you asked, is there a certain level of anxiety that's healthy? Absolutely. A certain level of aspiration beyond maybe where your skill or your academics will place you. I think that's fair. Like when you're sitting in your college guidance, they give you the layups, they give you the ones that are in your swing plane, and they give you a couple of stretch goals. But I don't, from the business side, I don't think there's, I think the margin is so significant across the whole spectrum of things that are being offered in the recruiting industrial complex that even a poorly run thing is still pretty profitable, or can be pretty profitable for the person running it. So as a result, you know, the proliferation of club teams, proliferation of events, the proliferation of multiple events going on the same day that could be really attractive to us. And we have myself and my two assistants are on the road trying to figure out which ones we should be at. So your question was maybe not necessarily how do we fix that. I think part of how personally we've done it, I have young assistants with children. Part of it is seeing the world through their prism of, you know, I'd like them to be home tucking their kids in at night. And so with certain events this summer, we just decided, you know what, we're going to that for one day. And it actually had the, in a positive way, the opposite effect. It meant, all right, I was going to see Terry Foy's team play two halves. But I had to be locked in, and you know, maybe he doesn't do some of the stuff that I missed another game, but I could lock in and watch him or watch his team, knowing that I wasn't going to be here the next day, but also knowing that because of what I talked about, there's probably three more weeks of recruiting, and that team's probably going to play at some other event, and I'll come across them. So I think part of how we do it, meaning the college coaches, is how do we look at the calendar? How do we control our own personal calendars, which means we have to control ourselves and sometimes our worst instincts. I used to be in the camp where I went to everything from early June to Battle of the Hotbeds at the end of July, back when that was a thing. And I took a lot of, whether it was Catholic pride or competitive pride in that, and being like, I am going to be there. But looking back, that was more ego and more competitive nature than productivity. And so I've kind of swung to the other round where, all right, what teams do we need to see? What new teams do we need to see? How many halves will we watch? You know, give us some opportunity maybe later in the middle of the summer if we don't get the assessment that we want. But what we can do individually as a staff is control the number of days that we go. Because if college coaches aren't at a lot of these events, the message that an event or a club coach is giving is affected by that. You told me that, you know, all the Ivy League coaches were going to be at something, and they're not. And so you would hope from a capitalist perspective that event would be hurt and maybe not be as strong, or lose some teams to another thing and then go away if it was a really bad event. That doesn't happen as fast in lacrosse, sadly. But I think if the college coaches can look at what they're doing, we can really kind of realize some of the influence that we have around some of the things that we complain about a lot, which is it's it's June 22nd, and Terry Foy looks like he's 49 years old running around out there. Well, one of the ways we affect that is you vote with where your body is, and you know that's a way for us to make some change in maybe how many games people are playing.
And there are rumors that at the coaches' convention in December, there will be conversation about either, well, basically just reducing the number of days that are available for evaluation. What's your expectation there? Because I agree with you. I think your endorsement, your presence is the commodity.
It's a vote.
Right?
We're advocating and validating, which is not, listen, some of my closest friends in this are club coaches and event operators and things like that, and a lot of them do a really good job, and they have the best interest of their players and their customers and their parents. They're on the front lines. They're the people that are not in between in the sense of being adversarial, but they're in between us and communicating with young kids and parents. As far as my optimism around it, I think it's a really big moment for the college coaches too. If one of the things we're worried about is the health and well-being and some of these injuries that are pre-existing, then I think we have an obligation to do that. I don't think it's just something we should think about. I think it's an obligation. This is our careers. Like this is, you know, when recruits are injured the whole time or they show up and they're not ready to play or things, that's pressure on us. You talk about anxiety. And so I think we have, I don't, whether we do something or not, I don't know. I don't know if I would consider myself optimistic or not, but what I would say is I think it's a moral and ethical obligation for us to do something.
Interesting. You mentioned that your staff wasn't on the road as much in the summer of 2024 as in prior summers. How do you feel like that manifested in the quality of your overall assessment of the class of 26 and then your recruitment of the class of 26?
I think that's a small sample, 20 years of doing this and a couple of hundred, you know, commits. And, you know, I think I'd be, you know, again, we're, you know, for us, we're data driven. We scan, we save, we extract, we chronicle. So there's nothing lost. We, you know, we get the game films from all the events, so we can go back and watch when we're trying to make. So Neil Hutchinson, who's our recruiting director, and Nick Grill and Mike Terranova and Carlin Joyle, our staff, you know, they're like, I wouldn't say like data hounds, but they're pulling all that stuff out. So, but that's kind of the way that I've always done it. It makes me feel good that, right, we can go, oh, what did I say about Terry Foy from, you know, the IDX experience? So, you know what I mean? Like, I can't remember. I know I liked him, but what did I write exactly? Or what did Neil write? Or what did someone else write? And so I don't think we did it any different other than the number of days. And I know I felt like happier and healthier, you know, relative to, and again, just sometimes just coming home for 36 hours is a good thing. And but
not,
as far as like predictive,
not starting your,
what's that?
Not starting your day with one of those like omelet sandwiches that's underneath a hot plate at a Holiday Inn Express is an incredible way to feel healthier. I can say that in terms of how I spent my weekend and how I've been feeling for the last three or four days.
But like as far as it being predictive, one of my lines is I evaluate our recruits when they graduate. You know, I just like, you know, whether they're ranked or recognized, like it's not why we're recruiting somebody. You know, we have guys in our class that was on nobody's radar or low on someone's radar, like beauty's in the eye of the beholder. So, I felt more excited to be at an event when I sat in my chair and I knew I was going to be there from 8 till 6 and I was going to be on the flight back to Boston at 8:30. Not that I was thinking about the 8:30 flight, but I was thinking, all right, I'm not going to leave here with a certainty. Maybe I will, but I want to like get smarter about these guys that, you know, we vetted out grades and some level of interest, and we've seen before, and now one of my assistants saw and they want me to see whether I agree or not. I felt fresher and more excited around forming an opinion.
This is not your world, but it is the thing that I have heard the most over the last month is around the proliferation of national teams and the way in which they've affected the rosters of the regional teams that they source their players from, and the ongoing issue of, I intend to reclass, so I am going to play down despite the fact that I am not actually in that grade. First of all, I say that it's not your world, it's not your issue, but that's an assumption. Is it? Do you have a strong opinion or care about that?
I don't, like, again, coming back to my, I'm not going to presume to know what the conversations are taking place around people's kitchen tables. You know, I think it gets back to your point around, you know, the aspiration, and not everybody can do that. So it creates, I wouldn't say it's an inequity, but it is an example of haves versus have-nots who have the ability to access, you know, better schools or more prestigious schools because of their skill, and maybe sometimes because of their income. Because those, you know, the boarding schools are really impressive places. Two of my children went to Culver. It was not the world that I, you know, that I grew up in, even though I went to Chaminade. Neither my dad, you know, and mom, I'm not sure they graduated from high school. And so like having my kids go to a boarding school was kind of unique, you know. So I've seen that world and what that world can kind of, the avenues that it can. And neither of my kids reclass, but I see the advantage of it, and I see the allure of it. And as a parent, your job is obviously to do some insulating. You're not raising bear cubs and you throw them into the wild. Is, you know, your job is to help direct your kids, not wrap them in bubble wrap, obviously. But you want to try to give you putting your kids in a direction where they can choose to be successful, knowing that you can't ensure it. So I don't judge parents and all of that. I sit next to people on the sideline complaining about, oh, so-and-so's carrying so-and-so's bag, or, you know, this guy's reclassing. I'm always like, how many kids you have? And then they go, none. Well, you need to shut the hell up, because you know, just because you were a son doesn't mean you know what it's like to have a son or a daughter. And so I don't judge that, you know. I think it can create kind of an inequity in that some people can do it and some can't. You know, again, people get to choose what's best for their kid. You know, I look at it, if I'm recruiting a goalie that's on a team that's lost a couple of kids to a national team, I'm looking at that. Well, that kid's going to probably see a lot more shots now, and now I'm going to really have a sense of whether he can save it. If he's a defenseman, he's going to play a lot of defense. You know what I mean? And so I think part of that is just a natural, you know, kind of libertarian approach. I want to try to do what's best for me and what's best for my son. Or the flip of that is, yeah, you know, you're not going to have a net zero effect on things like that. The national team stuff, you know, I think that started more in the beginning with teams that maybe couldn't field a team that could play against the top teams, or they are from non-traditional areas.
Right.
Now it's become, I think there's a little bit of ego part of that. And, you know, I there's some positives to it, and there's some negatives. Like, you know, playing on a team, it's like the age-old question. Should I play on a really good team with other really good players? Because by playing with them, I will by osmosis get better, and because I'm playing with really good players. Or do I play on a mid-level team where I have to do like three or four things, and I'm going to be forced to do things that I don't like to do or I'm not good at? And listen, I battled this when my son Pierre was choosing to go to the Catholic school in South Bend or go to Culver. Like, I think about it to this day. He had an unbelievable experience, played with, you know, really good players. But I do think about, or how would it have been different if he was forced to be the man versus being one of the men? And I don't know what the answer to that question is, but I don't judge parents for making either of those choices.
The answer to that question is to play in as many contexts as possible. Patrick McEwen touts this every single time the conversation comes up. The aspiration, the ideal would be the best player on a team and be the worst player on a team. And if you can have both of those experiences, it will accelerate your development as faster than pretty much anything else you can do. So how that happens for every individual, hard to say, right? We're talking about a player pool of hundreds of thousands of kids. But with that being said, we're getting near the end. We've touched on a lot of these topics already. Is there anything else you want to get to before we get out of here?
No, I think if there's parents listening, you know, it's really easy for adults like us to do these recruiting presentations at camps and talk about, you know, you got to love it and you know, just that, put these aphorisms out there that aren't necessarily untrue. But just because we do this for a living, we don't know everything. And most college coaches are really good people with really good, you know, moral and ethical backgrounds. We make mistakes. I make mistakes. I have to report myself when I make, you know, errors in recruiting. And, you know, so we're not like, I hope you don't look at us as being kind of the Wizards of Oz around this. You know, we have anxiety too. We know a lot, but we don't know everything. We see a lot, but we don't see everything. And there's an imperfect element on this. Sometimes to your earlier metaphor of like FOMO and I got to play in this last event and you watch a guy and it's like some Hollywood moment. Oh, he did the thing with the thing and, you know, and now, all right, now we want that guy. I don't think that happens as much as you think. You get to a point in your head and your heart where you're like, I like the way that I like what I've heard about him. I like talking to him. I like where he's going academically. I like the questions that he asked. Like, it's a real, for me, it's a real kind of algebra or calculus and all that stuff comes together. And then you decide. It's very rarely, like I can think of very few times where I've been struck by lightning. And I used to like go to an event, like, I just want to have this epiphany and be like, that would be easy. And then I've just gotten to, like, I don't look for it anymore. So that, when it does happen every once in a while, you're kind of open to it. So we don't know everything. We don't see everything. And what might be true on one day might not be true anymore a week later. And yeah, that can be bad delivering that information in the recruiting process for sure. And that could be hurtful and affect people. But I think in general, my advice would be, you know, make sure you understand why you're playing. You know, you should love it and you should hopefully have an aspiration to be as good as you can be. And if you have those two things, you'll probably find your level, you know, and being okay with that level, you know, conversely parents, you know, on the parent side is yeah. If you think about, you know, the top 20, there's some really aspirational schools in that group. And you think about if each school has 10 places, you can really see, out of the couple of 100,000, 5,000 people playing, you're talking about a couple of dozen places and probably even less when you start thinking positionally. You're still thinking about faceoffs and goalies. So, you know, be realistic. Have those layups, stretch goal, achievable goal, stretch goal. And then the last thing would be the parents and the kids should keep on asking the same questions over and over again so that they... So in case the answer changes. And lastly, you know, I think, you know, playing less games in the summer would make it less of a grind. You would have some breaks that would allow you to do the self-assessment that really good players do. When you have a game at 8, 11, 1 and 3 or 1 and 4 at an event, You're going from game, grabbing your bag, going to the team tent, shoving some sugar down your throat, going to the game. You're on your phone. You're not doing the assessment around, all right, what am I doing? What am I not doing? This is a piece that players aren't doing. Them being the master of their own game is the thing I think more than anything in the last 3 years has gotten lost as the lacrosse industrial complex has blown up. And so having some breaks where they go back and whether they work with an older brother or maybe a trainer in their town, or they go and have to experiment on their wall or on their field, I think that's really healthy. And that's how I did with my own children. We lived far away from everything. So they would play in a couple events in the summer because I wanted them begging me for the third or fourth event. I wanted them stalking me, saying, I want to play in this event. So that's what I would say.
How recruiting does not work with Harvard head coach Jerry Byrne. Thank you so much for joining us.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.